This episode of Lunch Agenda is sponsored by Brian Smith of Compass Real Estate. Brian helped me buy my house 5 years ago and wanted to support Lunch Agenda just like he supports so many of Washington's greatest causes. I encourage you to check him out at compass.com if you're ready to look at houses in DC. He is the best, and I'm happy to tell you all about him.
Tune into Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Hey everyone. Welcome to Lunch Agenda on Full Service Radio. We're broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in DC, and I'm your host, Kiko Bourne. Lunch Agenda is a podcast that schools you on parts of the food system that are less often explored than restaurants or celebrity chefs. You can check out past interviews with DC-based leaders like Ona Balkis and Michael Twitty, and national food advocates like Mark Bittman, Leah Penniman, and Julia Tertian. All the interviews are on your favorite podcast app, and the behind-the-scenes info and episode picks are at kikosfoodnews.com or KikoBuff on Instagram. This is the second episode in our Investing in Food series, which is made possible through a partnership with the Bainham Family Foundation. Over the past 50 years, Bainham has worked to improve the quality and availability of resources for children living in poverty to help them thrive. And in recent years, Bainham has become a dynamic funder of food-based initiatives in the Washington region, recognizing that access to nourishing food during childhood impacts health and learning outcomes later in life. Last week, Eric Hetzler of Arabella Advisors gave us an overview of the food investing landscape, after which Leela Otis of the Bainham Family Foundation and Celeste James of Kaiser Permanente discussed the approaches mission investors specifically use to assess investment opportunities. Today, I'll be talking with Chris Bradshaw and Tom McDougall, two food entrepreneurs who have identified gaps in Washington's food landscape and have founded a nonprofit, in Chris's case, and a business for Tom to address these gaps. And we'll be joined by Katie Jones, the director of Bainham's Food Security Initiative, who will help us understand how that foundation makes program-related investments to fuel this kind of work. But before we jump in, as always, let's kick things off with some Kiko's food news. We're doing a quick dose of news today because we have three brilliant guests to hear from. Headline one, remember last month's food news about Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's work on a Green New Deal that will tackle climate change through approaches like sustainable farming? Well, she recently made a comment about it on a late-night comedy show that conservatives are using to turn eating less meat into shorthand for socialism. Her exact words were, quote, "It's not to say we're going to force everybody to go vegan or anything crazy like that, but it's to say, listen, we've got to address factory farming. Maybe we shouldn't be eating a hamburger for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Let's keep it real," end quote. So that sounds pretty fair. But she also said, quote, "We set a goal to get to net zero rather than zero emissions in 10 years because we aren't sure that we'll be able to fully get rid of farting cows and airplanes that fast," end quote. So Republican pundits are now saying she's trying to steal America's burgers. And, you know, we're all now on the lookout for Hamburglar cartoons that may not be far away. Unbelievable. Second quick headline, coffee baristas are being introduced to super milk, which has more protein than regular milk and is extra fatty and creamy with up to 5% milk fat versus 3.25% in regular whole milk. Apparently, it produces a microfoam with an exceptional porcelain sheen, which is excellent for latte art. Oh, the things we worry about these days. Producers like Strauss Family Creamery in Northern California, which is a personal old favorite, began making the extra rich milk last year, and it's still a fairly underground product, but could it be the next craze after oat milk? We'll see. We're going to take a quick break to share a bit of information about an online tool for food education and job training that was just released by the Bainham Family Foundation. So stay tuned and we'll be right back. Hey, food people. Have you heard about the Food Learning Locator? Brought to you by the Bainham Family Foundation, it's a free online resource for exploring more than 100 food-related education and job training programs across the DC metro area. Whether you're looking for job training in the food industry, help growing your garden, or classes on food and nutrition, you can find it on the Food Learning Locator. And if your organization runs food-related programs, you'll want to be featured on this innovative interactive tool. Explore the map and learn more at foodlearninglocator.org. Welcome back, everyone. This is Kiko, and you're tuned into Lunch Agenda on Full Service Radio. Today is the second episode of our Investing in Food series, and we're going to look at how two different kinds of entities of a nonprofit organization focused on building opportunity for marginalized DC residents and a for-profit business focused on rural supply chains are approaching systemic gaps such as access to capital, food distribution infrastructure, and more. So the first guest I'd like to welcome to the mic is Chris Bradshaw, who I've asked every time I've seen him in the past year to let me interview him on my show. So welcome, Chris.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate you chasing me down finally.
My pleasure. Chris is a social justice entrepreneur whose expertise is in using social innovation through the food system to grow community economic development within marginalized communities. And Chris honed his organizing and entrepreneurial skills at Howard University, just a few minutes from here, after which he founded Dreaming Out Loud, a nonprofit which embraces urban agriculture and social enterprise as mechanisms for changing communities. Chris, like last week's guest Eric Kessler, is a member of the DC Food Policy Council, and he was also selected as one of 50 under 50 innovative leaders transforming Metro DC's food system. Chris, there may be no one in town who talks as frankly and clearly about, as you do, about the enduring legacy of structural racism on our food system. And I just want to start by asking you why that's a topic that you come back to when you're given the microphone on a panel or at the podium.
Yeah. Our food system is steeped in our history, and it's something that we can't escape. Until these challenges that are linked to our historical roots in chattel slavery, the theft of land from the indigenous folks of this continent, we can't fashion a sustainable solution because we're not acknowledging the origins. And so we want to have conversations that challenge those folks who want to either push those conversations to the side, those who make decisions about folks' futures without those folks at the table, and those who are also unafraid to challenge the structure of our economic system and the way that capitalism has formed around exploiting those historical realities.
And I really just launched into the heavy stuff with you right away.
That's all right.
But you know, this is a topic that you do circle around every time, or not circle around, address directly every time that I've seen you speak to huge audiences. Can you share one or two examples of you know, specific historical racism and the mark that it's left on our food system?
Yeah, I mean, you could start with the wealth that was created by having free labor, you know. it's awfully
easy to have in agriculture.
In agriculture, yeah. Free labor. You could get your farm up and going pretty quick and turn a nice profit if you don't have to pay anyone.
Let alone the knowledge that was brought, you know, whether it was for rice or other crops. Mm-hmm. We discussed this in my last series, but that was huge exploitation of knowledge.
Yeah, of knowledge, of, you know, tens of thousands of years of human history that's then absorbed and taken and used to transform one group of people's futures into one of wealth and prosperity while robbing another group of people of that. And then we don't talk about the kind of cascading implications of that wealth theft. So then you're therefore building a better school with more labs, or donating to that university that also benefited from, you know, slave labor. And those things just compound over time and over time, and then we don't address the root causes. We look for Band-Aids, but we want to kind of peel back the scab and peel back those Band-Aids and get right to the pain points. I think that for me, in my personal family history, I grew up in Tennessee, but a lot of my family's from Georgia, particularly Valdosta, very near the Florida-Georgia line. It was a little joke
because
it was
a country group. Yeah, go ahead, bust into it.
But no, but very seriously, part of my family is connected to Rosewood, Florida, which was a black community that was burned to the ground as a result of a false rape accusation by a white woman against a black man. And so they raised essentially a militia and came and burned that town to the ground. And the backbone of that community's economy was farming, and there was also like a turpentine plant. So you have these acts of racial violence that were used as a way to strategically rob people of their ability to build those exact same things that you want for your community: great schools, access to healthy food, ability to build a future, directly tied to those acts of violence. And I would be willing to bet that, you know, there was some rival farmer who was mad at those black farmers being able to get their crops to market and to be able to escape some of the sharecropping and other arrangements that are built on, you know, feudal ideas of ways to use land and who profits from land.
And just a quick plug, Chris tells this story in a lot more detail on an interview on another full service radio show hosted by Melissa Jones. It's called Edible Activist, and that was a really great personal interview that I recommend listeners check
out.
Shout out
to Melissa.
Yeah. So as it relates to history's effect on today, one specific area that I think seems to maybe be the biggest residual inequity is access to land. Can you tell us anything about the history of land loss that was experienced by farmers of color in our area of the Washington region?
I'm sure there are hundreds. I can't think of any specific ones in this specific region. I guess the closest thing that I could recall, you know, Harriet Tubman's ancestral lands are located just down the road. And friends of ours at Black Dirt Farm were there farming on her ancestral lands. And you can only help but imagine what size they must have been, or what she had prior to, you know, the kind of loss that happens over time when you try and pass something down and there's a, you know, family member that wants to sell or doesn't want to sell. But I think those stories of land loss through not having access to the legal system and things like that happens all the time.
And also not having access to bank loans. You know, one of the biggest takeaways I had from Leah Penniman's recent book, Farming While Black, was just the whole history of redlining and how certain neighborhoods that were predominantly African-American were denied access to loans as a whole. And so, you know, most people need to take out a loan to get their hands on some land.
Yeah, the Pickford, the black farmers case was based upon that settlement, which, you know, I think landed around $2 billion or so. But I'm quite sure that number is significantly reduced from what the real damage and the real cost was. So it happens all the time.
So fast forwarding to 2019, who exactly do you think is most underserved by our current food system? What are the gaps right now?
Yeah, if we're talking about the urban environment as it is presently constituted, I think in this city, black and brown food service workers, black entrepreneurs are denied access to the resources needed to get started, undercapitalized. With the rising costs and the changing demographics as a result of gentrification and displacement, you're also undercutting folks' potential economic base for growing a food business. It's a longer process to get white folks to think of entrepreneurs of color as their go-to, right? As their normative place for such and such product. Sometimes it can be very niche and like, oh, there's the barbecue guy, but how many times are you going to go back to that Staples, you know, food provider, or to recognize that, you know, somebody as an entrepreneur might be coming from a different place. You know, we launched a program called Dreaming Out Loud's Ready for Entrepreneurship Accelerator Modules, which is aimed at finding and accelerating marginalized food entrepreneurs. And folks' stories are not ones where they have had formal culinary training. So for us, it's like, how do we accelerate their growth by building an ecosystem that can help whatever that entrepreneurial spirit, whatever drives them, how do we bring that out, help them refine things and tell their story in a way that benefits them? We have one guy, Rayford, who has a company called Torch Porch. He learned to make burritos while incarcerated because they were deprived of, you know, microwaves and things to make food. And so they improvised and disassembled an iron and began making burritos. So that's his product now. And for us, you know, without that formal culinary training, how do we help him to refine recipes, access markets, access capital, and then make up for the gaps when folks have been underserved for their entire lives and multiple generations? And so for us, there's one part of a discussion about what, you know, the DC government might be able to do and how philanthropy can help us to serve some of these folks. But it's a bigger question about what this nation has to do to catch folks up. We can't talk about closing the racial wealth gap if we don't talk about why it exists and what fundamental things need to happen. For us, reparations is one of those conversations that we have. And the need to, I would say, challenge the notion of dependence on government, right? You hear that a lot, and it's repeated. You can hear it repeated amongst liberal democratic circles and conservative circles. But I think there's a fundamental underlying lie that we aren't all dependent on government in some shape, form, or fashion. You know, you can look back at the GI Bill. You can look at my home state, the Tennessee Valley Authority. You have folks repeating these lies when you would be in the dark without the, you know, New Deal programs. That was the government. We talk about the devastation after World War II, the Marshall Plan. That was the government. I would hate to think what Europe would have been had it had to stand itself up with its entire economy flattened without that Marshall Plan. So when you talk about our communities and using that Rosewood example, having your entire economic base devastated, the loss of land, the knowledge, all of those things, it requires an equal response. But we haven't seen those responses. We've seen piecemeal things. We've had one step forward and then a backlash. So we're sitting here in the wake of these things and still doing the work, still plugging forward, but we don't want to be idealistic and kind of in the clouds about what our work really means. It takes place against the backdrop of these historical realities.
It's a really powerful analogy or set of analogies you make, where you're showing examples of equal response and how there that is not happening right now. And I really like how you highlighted this proclivity for people to assume that a black entrepreneur might be doing niche things, such as you said, barbecue or, you know, soul food or whatever it might be. And, you know, highlighting Torch Porch, here's a burrito company that's African-American owned and run. And I think it's really important that we broaden, as you say, the notion of what perspectives might be brought in leading different kinds of businesses that are not those assumed niche ones. Yeah. What role is Dreaming Out Loud playing in addressing these issues?
Yeah, I think our first obligation is to speak truth to power and bring our voice to the table and bring other folks whose voices might not be heard as often or as loudly to the table. I also believe that our work on the ground also looks like rebuilding the capacity and infrastructure from within communities to be able to have more control over their own localized food system or regionalized food system. So for us, that does mean part the knowledge transfer and in terms of skills that we have on staff and that we're able to build around communities, and also receiving historical and cultural knowledge and using that as a base to, you know, take those next step forward so that folks understand that we're not wholly inventing new things. We've done these things and had responses to circumstances before, but that just today, moving on in time, that the technology is going to play a different role, that kind of new formations of new companies and food hubs and other language and terminology that's coming into play are going to be bigger and bigger realities for this next version of an equitable food system. So we want to also familiarize people with these ideas and these thoughts, but not losing the connectivity between culture and history and folks' identity. So there's also the very real infrastructural part of the food system as well. In our approach, we use a community asset-based approach where, you know, there might be a church with a commercial kitchen that could support somebody like Rayford. So for us, it's also understanding what the politics and the dynamics of entering into conversation and partnership with a faith-based institution, pairing it with some technical knowledge. So we worked with Institute for Justice to another organization that does a lot of work around economic freedom to start to develop a shared commercial kitchen guide that could be used in DC as they had done in Chicago. So that way, when we're having those conversations, you know, you're able to give somebody something that shows you, here's a technical way of getting at, you know, what we're all trying to get to, so it doesn't seem so nebulous. You know, part of our work is centered at the farm and food hub at Kelly Miller, so we'll be, you know, putting infrastructure there and building capacity to have more impact than just what one little, you know, 2-acre farm can grow. You know, distribution and processing are huge parts of the food system and where a lot of the jobs will come from in the future. And so we want to be ahead of those curves in terms of helping people to understand what those look like, helping to shape policy that could not only accelerate the growth of jobs in those areas, but that can deepen the ability to reach people. So,
What is one or two policy issues right now that are on the table that at least local listeners might want to learn about and maybe start talking about?
Yeah, so one is the Good Food Purchasing Program, which the district has recently adopted, and there's been a lot of conversation about in within the DC Food Policy Council. So we're really, really excited about the adoption of that platform, but we need to see more policy action that increases the spending on local products. You know, for instance, you know, if you're looking at school food as a way to potentially work with entrepreneurs or cooperatives around producing, accessing that institutional market, you know, if all schools have to spend is 45, 50 cents on an item, well, what kind of living could an entrepreneur really make by providing that for a school or a cooperative or an organization? It makes folks cut corners. It just drives a lot of inequity in terms of, you know, folks cut corners on wages and you know, worker protections, environmental protections. So we want to see increased spending that makes it possible for these solutions to or these options to be available for people.
Perfect. Thank you. That is a policy that I am really passionate about and have the privilege of following closely from where I sit at a school with an amazing kitchen that's trying to make those purchases. So, Chris, we're gonna try to move over to our next guest, and we're going to have to use our imaginations for a moment to picture Tom McDougal sitting in the studio with us. He's actually at this very moment making a presentation at South by Southwest about regenerative agriculture. But I really did want to get his perspective into this conversation about gaps in our food system. So I interviewed Tom just a couple days ago, and here is our interview. I want to turn to our next guest, Tom McDougall, who's the founder of 4P Foods, a local benefit corporation that procures, aggregates, and distributes good food across the metropolitan area. The 4Ps stand for purpose, people, planet, and profit. Tom, tell us about why you started 4P Foods. Was it to address gaps that Chris has talked about today, or are there different issues you're positioned to address with the business?
Yeah, I think both and. I mean, what Chris talks about is very much part of not just the broken food system, but broken historical institutions writ large that affect all aspects of life in here in D.C. and beyond. So yes, but I think a big part of it, at least for me, was a personal passion. Right? Like I grew up in a farming community, grew up working on a farm that failed, frankly, and was sold off in 100-acre chunks throughout my childhood to developers that built McMansions because it's really, really hard to make a living as a farmer. And my father, meanwhile, is a grocer, and early in his career, he bought a lot of food from a lot of local farms, and because that's kind of how the food system worked. But over the last 40, 50 years, it's become a lot less of that, and good, honest, local, regional food suddenly is very much the exception instead of the norm, and we wanted to try to build something that could help reverse that.
And I did know that you were raised in the ag region of the Hudson Valley. What kind of farm were you referring to?
So it was largely a farm community, and I worked on a couple, but the one that was directly surrounded my neighborhood, or my childhood home, was a beef cattle operation.
Wow.
And they had mixed vegetable garden and chickens, and next to that was, again, mixed vegetable, horse, hay production farm, and it was cool. It was cool
and,
to grow up.
And I know that your first job after college, you talk about how it had you traveling back and forth to China, and it really drilled in this notion of externalized costs. But where else did you learn the skills that you've needed to run the 4P business? And I should actually have you just explain how 4P works exactly, too.
Yeah, sure. We're a food hub. The USDA puts food hubs into generally three categories. There's B2C food hubs, which aggregate from lots of farms and then delivers directly to consumers. B2B food hubs, business to business, that aggregates from farms and then sells to chefs and caterers and retailers and, in the best case scenario, schools, hospitals, institutions. And then there are hybrid food hubs that are a combination of both of those. So what we do, what we have done historically for the last 5 years is we're in bucket number one, where we aggregate from a couple hundred farms in the mid-Atlantic, produce, meat, dairy. We source from local food entrepreneurs like the ones that Chris is developing with Dreaming Out Loud, ideally. And we deliver that kind of food directly to consumers in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. And it's sort of easy to capture it in the sense like we're trying to target the customer that loves the idea of going to the farmer's market, but either can't because of lack of access or doesn't because of lack of time or any combination, and therefore they aren't spending their food dollars in the local food system. We're trying to make that easier. So at a very high level, that's what we do.
And why were you the guy to do it?
I'm still not sure that I am. We are still figuring it out as we go very much. Part of the skill set, I think, came, again, just sort of like the passion of growing up, how I grew up, like my dad being a grocer, working on the farm. My mom is a wonderful cook. I thought I wanted to be a chef for a long time, so food was kind of in my DNA. And then you're right, my experience in China helped me begin to understand the concept of externalized costs in a global capitalist system that measures profits at all costs. So oftentimes the price of things is not an accurate representation of the cost of things. A Big Mac and fries might be $4 and that's the price, but what about the cost on our environment to make that beef patty and our public health and the people who make it? And so yes, that was an eye-opening experience. Prior to that, I had spent much of my younger life doing various sales jobs. I sold kitchen cutlery in people's homes for 4 years through college, which taught me the sort of hard work of storytelling and sales and building a book of business. I worked in restaurants, front of house, back of house. So it was sort of a strange combination that came together to be a food distribution, logistics, and storyteller guy,
yeah.
For better or for worse.
This must be why we get along. I was a knife seller, too.
Ah, how about that?
From Williams-Sonoma's corporate headquarters. So wow. Not quite as cool. I didn't need to be quite as resilient, but...
Yes, good old cutlery.
Yes, yeah. Cutlery and cutting boards. And you said something interesting when you described the mission and work of 4P in the sense that you're trying to reach those customers that might not have access to the farmer's market, but, you know, are that type of buyer, which to me is a pretty strong connection to what Chris has talked about with access. Is it often geographic access that you're referring to? And if so, are you really... intentionally delivering to areas that don't have farmers markets where local food is available, or how are you really adding to access in that way?
Yeah, that's something that for us has changed over time, right? The more that we've started to understand the food landscape in DC and beyond and ask ourselves what is our role? As a benefit corporation, we have a stated mission that is one of duality, like many food hubs, where it's how do we create a better system where farmers that are producing good food using regenerative practices, how do we give them access to markets so they can not just survive and eke by, but how can they thrive? And simultaneously, how do we make sure that the people that are consuming that food have access to it regardless of their zip code or their income or other factors? Because often the farm-to-table movement really services the white, affluent, educated populace. So how do we do that? And that's a challenging mission to have because oftentimes those two things are sometimes at odds with each other. Like, how do we pay farmers X, an accurate price for what they deserve, but then sell it at a price that, to be affordable, is often lower than X? And that delta, that spread, that mathematical conundrum is the reason that grocery stores, by and large, have pulled out of certain communities and created food deserts, among other, as Chris eloquently talks about, historical sets of institutional racism and sexism and classism that fuel that fire. So what is our role? So we think, at least in our work, about food access as sort of three major buckets. There are, of course, more, but there is a geographic access problem. How close is the food that you're trying to procure and consume? Financial access, even if it is close, is it at a price point that makes sense for your personal budget? And then personal access, even if it's there and it is affordable, do you have the time or the tools or the knowledge or the desire to prepare and consume a healthy meal? So we do a few things. We have set up some of our own distribution points in places like Ward 7 and Ward 8. But increasingly, the thing that we really like to do and want to really double and triple down on is partnering with others that are already on the ground, because what 4P does fairly well is the geographic access component. We're pretty good at aggregating from lots of rural farms, producing really good food, managing a cold chain, getting trucking logistics, and getting it into neighborhoods. And then working with people like Dreaming Out Loud and Community Food Works and Arcadia and others who are already part of these communities, we want to be their good food supply chain. And make sure that they can not just operate, but operate year-round and have a good variety, and we want to supplement the farms that are already there. So I think that while we have sort of played a role in helping to set up farmers markets in Ward 7 and with the YMCA run cooking classes with that food, that's all great. We want to, I think, in the coming years, really focus on our role of the geographic access problem of this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what stage of growth is 4P in right now, would you say?
We're at a cool kind of pivotal moment. We have quite a few big things going on where the food hub nerds of the world have kind of begun to get together and look at food hubs for the last decade, and it was by and large food hub 1.0, where it was aggregate from some farmers and distribute. But food hubs have yet to prove that they are a viable, financially sustainable model. So what does Food Hub 2.0 look like? And how do we make it more of the norm for local food to be in local food systems? And what we are beginning to talk about is that Food Hub 2.0 might look like a network of food hubs across a region. our friends at Farm Fair in Ohio, who are building food hub networks, call it not economies of scale, but economies of collaboration. Mm. In Vermont, for example, they've built really good food hub networks and collaborative coalitions. And as a result, the amount of food that gets purchased by Vermont schools is 17%. Whereas in somewhere like Virginia, that has a far more diverse and longer growing season, the amount of food that comes from local sources in the state is 3%.
Wow.
And it has a lot to do with that lack of infrastructure cohesion and cross-collaboration across a bigger geographic area.
That's a segue to the last kind of topic I want to ask you about with regard to 4P, which is how you fund this work. So I heard you say at some point, maybe at a conference a year or two ago, that you were originally coached to get private equity investment, and that didn't work for you. Why was that?
Yeah, that could be a whole series of podcasts in itself. It's not just me. I think there is generally a culture in our country right now that has put startup entrepreneurs, for better or for worse, on a pedestal and created a sort of farce of rock star status, and here's how you do it. If you Googled how to start a business and how to finance a business, it would point you in the direction of Silicon Valley, seed stage, angel investors, sell some equity, scale at all costs, Series A, Series B, Series C, and then exit, and it doesn't matter if you own 2% of your company because it's worth a gazillion dollars. There is so much wrong with that, especially if we're going to talk about distribution of wealth. Who has access to those Rolodexes? Who has access to even that initial seed stage funding? And who benefits from it long term? It costs, on average right now in America, about $38,000 to launch a successful startup. The average white family's net worth in America is $117,000. The average black family's net worth is $11,000. So if the message to underserved communities and entrepreneurs is just go call your rich uncle so you can start your hot sauce company or your cupcakery or whatever, what happens if you can't even make that call? The system from the get-go is rigged to protect the wealth of those that already have it. So for me, knowing that food systems are thin margin and that entire financing business model is sort of the antithesis of what it means to build a good food company and spread that wealth, I knew that wasn't the direction. However, that quickly created a problem because it was like, what do you do then? There is this idea of social impact investing and doing well and doing good, and even that has its own challenges. Like, conscious capitalism sort of touts a new way of doing business, and yet does it not continue to maintain the status quo by continuing to give access to people who already have access?
Isn't conscious capitalism the term that was invented by John Mackey or you know, spread by John Mackey, who sold to Amazon?
Yeah, yep, exactly. So it's good that I think there's a narrative about being better conscious business owners. I think it's good that people are asking the question, what is the purpose of business in society? I think it can be potentially slippery slope if we rest on our laurels to say that the Tom Shoes model of buy one, give one, and doing good things is the way that we should be thinking about social enterprise, because it's just not. Which is not an answer to your question, but
so
that's why it didn't work for me.
So what kind of investment did you go for? What was the right kind for you?
Yeah, when we first started, I had no idea. I knew it wasn't going to California and San Francisco and trying to find money that I didn't have. So my wife and I started with our life savings and put that in, and then used that as some money on the balance sheet to then go to a local bank, Eagle Bank. It was just enough to underwrite an SBA loan with our assets as the collateral on it. So we started with debt. What would have been like the angel investor friends and family round, we didn't have rich friends and family. So we started off pretty scrappy and started with debt. And then off we went. And then when it was time, like when sales were growing and it was clear that we were kind of onto something, it became obvious that we would need more resources to hire a sales team and buy a second truck, and we needed better refrigeration and like the investments we needed to get to another level. And that was when, like, the path got really tricky, because it was now we would have been potentially ready for VC funding. We would have been ready for that kind of capital, because we had the narrative and had the growth and had the trajectory and everything else. And being a white dude, I probably could have gotten access to those channels. But again, if we're talking about building a food system, it took us 40 or 50 years to really break our current one. I would posit that it's going to take another 40 or 50 to potentially fix it. And that timeline does not align with 40. Venture capital.
Yeah. Right. Right.
I started to hear about and learn and self-educated about this sort of world of social impact investing and what it meant. And some of it's great. Some of it is not. But I was invited to have a conversation with the Washington Regional Food Funders, which is a fantastic group. It's where we met Katie. And it was the first time that I had kind of thrown out the advice that I had gotten from the sort of investor world, which is like, yeah, it's great that you're a mission-driven company, but maybe don't talk about that. Why don't you talk about the unit economics of selling to affluent white people in Northern Virginia, because that's fundable. And the extra stuff, put that at the end of your slide deck in an appendix.
Wow.
And after 6 months of sort of doing that but not owning it, because it didn't feel right, Washington Regional Food Funders was the first time where I was like, I'm going to throw out all of that advice and kind of say what we're about, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And that began a relationship with Katie and the Bainham Family Foundation, because as it turns out, what I have since learned is that actually there is a whole other way of doing funding and whole other resources and certain kinds of capital that are looking for mission-driven companies that are doing so for more than just the marketing ploy.
Right. And so the Bainham Family Foundation announced last year, I think, right, that it was making a program-related investment, or as they call it, PRI, in 4P Foods. How is their investment helping your business at this point to build the good food supply chain?
Yeah, it in many ways, first and foremost, it gave me and my team a lot of confidence that we were on the right path. Because prior to that, again, all of this sort of unknown and how are we going to fund, how are we going to grow, everyone's saying we should go get this kind of capital. Are they right? It doesn't feel right, but what are we going to do? It was really validating that we should keep at it. And in fact, not just hide our mission and do it anyway, but really double and triple down and lean into our mission. And they're holding us accountable to it, which is mm-hmm. which is great. So if nothing else, it put wind in our sails. It also validated other similar like-minded investors who were also interested in 4P but didn't want to go alone to come in and join them and join us, because now it was a team of people, right?
Absolutely.
So that was extremely helpful. And all told, those resources have helped us to hire a sales team, invest in better technology so it's not so clunky, upgrade one of our vehicles. We just moved into a new facility to get more space, to add more freezer space we can rent out to farmers.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you. It's been an exciting year. So they've really just kind of helped us to lean into this next step of growth for us, which involves merging with another hub in the region. That would effectively make us a hybrid company, so we'll have the B2C, we'll have the B2B, and we'll be able to really kind of step into hopefully being one of the anchor organizations in this food hub, food port regional network.
Speaking of the Bainham Family Foundation's investment, I have Katie Jones, who Tom was just speaking about, with us in studio. As Bainham's Food Security Initiative Director, Katie leads efforts to partner with other organizations cultivating more affordable outlets for nutritious food in DC's Ward 7 and 8. She develops and hosts the Food Learning Locator, and she collaborates with the Bainham Foundation Farm. She also serves as a board observer for 4P Foods, a steering committee member for the Washington Regional Food Funders, and an advisory committee member for the Metropolitan Washington Council of Government's Local Food Distribution Working Group. So, Katie, welcome. I would like to ask you a bit about how your team at the foundation has chosen to fund the approach that Tom is spearheading with 4P, you know, how that partnership began and what it's looked like from your perspective.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Kiko. At the Bainham Family Foundation and our food security initiative, we really think that building an increased supply of local and regionally produced food is really critical to building a healthy and equitable food system, not only because it helps improve the taste and the nutritional properties of the food, but it also creates more economic opportunities in our local regional supply chain through the food system, and it improves our regional food security. So that being said, we saw an investment in an organization like 4P Foods as a really critical way to help build the connective tissue and start to infuse this ability to move more good food into DC and the surrounding areas to support producers who are growing food the right way, both from an equity perspective and also from a growing practices perspective, but also to make that food more accessible for all consumers who are interested in that kind of food in their daily life. So we were just really excited to come across Tom at the Washington Regional Food Funders, but also he just kept showing up at all the kinds of different nonprofit organization meetings. And so we had a chance to really get to know him and to understand for him, it was not just about supply chain. It was just not about moving food around, but it was doing it with intention and purpose. And you can see that from the way that he talks about the mission of his organization, the fact that he is a benefit corporation and so has chosen to prioritize that mission alongside his sort of business bottom line. And then also the fact that he, you know, kind of went through this long fundraising journey and ultimately decided that mission-oriented capital was the right decision for his business.
And the investment in 4P is an example of program-related investments for Bainham. So can you, and can those go to either a nonprofit organization or a for-profit organization, or is that really the specific vehicle that you use to invest in for-profit businesses? And can you tell us a little bit about that section of your giving portfolio?
Yeah, that's a great question. So to date, we're pretty early stage in using PRIs as an instrument for change at the organization. But what they're really enabling us to do is to say, regardless of your tax status, if you're a solution that's helping to create a better food system, we want to explore if there's a partnership opportunity with you. And so PRIs can be used for either for or nonprofit organizations, but what their primary defining characteristic is that they're coming out of our programmatic investing, not out of our endowment, and they're intended towards a mission-oriented impact and not specifically a financial return, although that can be sort of a secondary result, you know, sort of behind the mission priority. You know, as we think about you know, the role of foundations in sort of changing the food system and what PRIs present, it's an opportunity for us to really take some of the risk that the food system has proven it's not willing to take in a mainstream way, and to support early stage businesses who are trying to do things a different way and create opportunities for great producers and great consumers to come together and start to change the way this food system looks.
What I hear from you is kind of an echo of what Eric Kessler was talking about in the first episode, where foundations can come in at the earliest phases where it might be highest risk and really, you know, build demand and kind of begin shifting the system before other investors are willing to join the party. And to prove the point that PRIs, you know, both support for-profit businesses like 4P and nonprofits, can you share a little bit of a preview about what's developing between you and Dreaming Out Loud as we speak?
Yeah, absolutely. Like you, Kiko, I have been talking to Chris for a long time and just really admire the work that he and the Dreaming Out Loud team are doing. So we're really excited to announce that we're working in a partnership for starting in 2019 to help build Dreaming Out Loud's capacity in some of the areas that Chris talked about. And what I think we're most excited about with their approach to their food system work is that they really do take a community asset-based approach to their work. We're thrilled about the areas that they're working in with respect to social enterprise, and I think it really speaks to what Chris was saying about needing to look for solutions that are not just Band-Aids, but are really creating new opportunities to have the conversations we need to have to change the food system, and also to create new pathways for different people to participate in a meaningful way to shape and to own the way that our food system looks.
I can't wait to follow along with that. I think it's really exciting. And Chris, I do want to back up and ask you the same question I asked Tom, which is about your strategy to sourcing investment. How have you gone about seeking funding from all the different places that it might be available?
Yeah, our philosophy has been to look at where our values align first, and folks who can understand where we're coming from and the challenges we're working towards. You know, there are both as an organization that we call ourselves a cooperative social enterprise, we're able to accept both philanthropic and other types of funding.
Oh, interesting. And
so we want to develop these revenue generating aspects of our work, but they're also deeply needed aspects of our work that aren't going to produce a return and that will have to be supported philanthropically. And so we work to thread that needle. We have tough conversations in the community about, you know, free food programs that undercut the ability to build out an ecosystem or a healthy food system in the neighborhood. We have conversations with other nonprofits about the ways in which they're tracking and measure and understand the labor and the work that it takes to produce something. And so we want to have these conversations so that other folks who are brought to the table with us or who are going to go out and do their own thing have a grasp of these things when they're encountering a Bainham Family Foundation or another organization, so that that language is there when they're ready to, you know, take those next steps. Because there's a lot of great activity going on, but if we're not having the conversations about, you know, what barriers block solutions, it's on both sides. It's having conversations with funders about what capacity needs are really there for organizations, particularly Black or brown led, and having folks on the other side of the coin in the community to help bring them up to speed so that, you know, both groups can talk to each other. So for us, you know, some of that work is going to get funded through selling vegetables and value-added products, and other parts are just going to have to be, you know, a part of the more deeper, you know, social justice-related work.
And this topic of the language of the food system and of investment sourcing is something that we're going to dive into a little bit deeper with Dennis Derrick of Corbin Hill Food Project in the last episode of the series. So I encourage listeners who want to hear more about that to tune in. And I'm intrigued by this cooperative social enterprise model that you mentioned. Is that the same as like what we would think of as a traditional co-op, like a grocery co-op or a bakery co-op?
I would say it would bear some of the hallmarks. I'm a both and, not an either or person. So for us, you know, even in designing the entrepreneurship program, we didn't want to reject that solo entrepreneur who might want to stand up their own bakery, but we also didn't want to reject folks who were thinking in a more cooperative fashion. It's how do you bring them both together, perhaps around cooperative infrastructure or cooperative functions, that produces a cooperative result, even though it might not be a formal cooperative. In terms of the way we traditionally think about things.
Huh.
So, you know, that might include co-packing and co-processing around a shared workforce. Lots of interesting ways to be innovative in the ways that we deliver scale and capacity to folks who are doing the work that not necessarily doesn't fit into either bucket so neatly.
Huh. It's interesting. I just think that's kind of something that you don't hear of as much, is that hybrid.
Yeah.
Very innovative. Before we move on to action items with the little time we have left, I just want to ask the two of you with me today about your North Star. Because as I said in the first episode of this series, I see investment in food as, you know, a way of looking ahead and kind of forecasting where the system is going, where investors see the landscape going. So I would like to ask each of you, Chris, as a leader of your organization and Katie as a funder, what the food system looks like if your work or investment pay off.
Mm-hmm. I think our work looks like transferring some of the work that we do to folks in the neighborhoods and communities where we work, so that that ownership is taken to another level and really means owning it. You know, I think that our work also looks like people being able to remain in their neighborhoods and communities. I think that our work is also a call to organize, to make sure that we build a city and build cities in a nation that is equal for all and opportunity for all. And so for us, it's not letting those things fall by the wayside. That is the North Star. Food is just a conduit to make those things happen.
Right. Katie, what about you?
Yeah, to echo what Chris was saying, I think that as we think about the work that we're doing, we're so early stage now, and we've had the opportunity to develop partnerships with incredible organizations. But ultimately, if we're successful in collaboration with our partners, the food system is a much more inclusive space in the future, and you're seeing a fabric of solutions that are comprehensively meeting the needs of everyone in our local community and their nutritional needs, but also giving them an opportunity to increasingly participate, own, and shape what those food solutions look like so that they are really not just receiving solutions, but co-creating them.
Sounds difficult, but, you know, sounds like we're getting closer. And we're going to be having voices from other parts of the country in other episodes of this series also to kind of give us windows into what that might look like. Action items. It's time for you to each share one little thing, one quick thing, because I need to turn the studio over to the next show that you'd like listeners to do in our day-to-day to change our food system.
Mm-hmm. Purchase from somebody who looks different than you. Find a black or brown entrepreneur and buy some food. Find a black farmer to support. I would say also plug into the Food Policy Council and make your voice be heard at that level, because policy is how we make long-term systemic change. And then third, you can follow Dreaming Out Loud at DOLDC across all social media platforms, and click the donate button.
Perfect. Katie?
Yeah, very similarly, I was going to say, I think a lot of people do a good job of asking, you know, what's on their food, how does it affect the environment, what growing practices were used, but starting to ask who produced the food and who sells it and what does that mean for the food economy in their region and who they're supporting with their food choices.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Tom had a quick action item. Can you play it, Jamal? Tom, what is your lunch agenda action item? What is the one thing that you want listeners to do in our day-to-day to change our food system for the better?
Spend more of your food dollar, as much as you can, if you have a dollar, in the local food system. If you can join a local CSA with a local farm, do that. If you can't, go to Community Food Works or Dreaming Out Loud's markets and procure food from there.
What about procuring from 4P? How do we do that?
Also an option. I know our website makes it fairly easy, 4pfoods.com. But really being conscious about how we spend the limited dollars that we do have for a better system can be the most powerful. And if there's free time beyond that, plant some food and talk to your local legislators about better food policy. Here in D.C., there's the D.C. Food Policy Council. It's easy to get involved. Be part of the long-term change.
Thanks, Tom. And thank you, Chris. And thank you, Katie, for sitting with me today and brainstorming these opportunity areas that we can each pursue from wherever we sit. And I want to make sure people can follow Tom as well. He's at 4P Foods on Instagram and Twitter. Next week, in the third episode of our Investing in Food series, we'll talk with leaders from the Capital Area Food Bank and the Arcadia Center for Sustainable Food and Agriculture about how funder-supported market-based solutions can help people move from dependence on free food to participating in the economy as a retail consumer, a theme that Chris was just referring to. And then we'll close out the series in the fourth episode, exploring the idea of food sovereignty, from how we can ensure equitable access to food funding to how funders and recipients are working towards equitable ownership and participation in food ventures. So thank you all for joining us today, and we'll talk with you soon. This is Kiko. Thanks for tuning into Lunch Agenda.